Hello and welcome to The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading this week from the June 21st through 27th edition of The Economist. We'll begin, as usual, with The Leaders, a collection of five articles this week to represent the major events and themes of the week. The first will be Conflict in the Middle East. Where will the Iran-Israel war end? Subheading, in a worse place if Donald Trump rushes in. Second, a new pug test. To keep Russia out and America in, NATO must spend more. Subheading, European members need a hard date to boost their defense budgets. Third, a fiscal fable, Japan's government bonds. This time it won't end well. Subheading, even as interest costs mount, politicians promise handouts. Fourth, baby brain. Why MAGA's pro-natalist plans are ill-conceived. Subheading, efforts to deliver a baby boom either fail or cost a fortune. Fifth and finally, computers versus creatives. What the cockroaches of the ad world teach about dealing with AI. Subheading, a rosé-soaked meeting in Cannes is like a postcard from the future. Following the reading of those five leaders' articles, we'll turn to the main section of the magazine for articles from the United States, the Americas, Asia, China, Middle East and Africa, Europe, and Britain, all, of course, as time allows. So, turning now to that first leaders article, we have the title, Conflict in the Middle East. Where will the Iran-Israel war end? Subheading, in a worse place if Donald Trump rushes in. In the 20 months since Hamas massacred almost 1,200 people, Israel has fought in Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. On June 13th, when Israeli aircraft struck Iran, it became clear that these campaigns waged against Iranian clients and proxies have all been leading to today's momentous confrontation between the Jewish state and the Islamic Republic. The Iran-Israel war will reshape the Middle East, just as Arab-Israeli wars did between 1948 and 1973. As President Donald Trump teeters between talking to Iran and sending American aircraft and missiles to bomb it, the question is whether this first Iran-Israel war will also be the last, thereby creating space for a new regional realignment built on economic development. Or will it lead to a series of Iran-Israel wars that mire the Middle East in years, if not decades, of further violence? Israeli minds are focused on the looming threat of a nuclear-armed Iran. Israel claims that it acted now because Iran has been racing towards a bomb under the cover of arms talks with America. Western intelligence agencies are less sure. Either way, a nuclear Iran could abuse its neighbors with impunity, much as Vladimir Putin has Ukraine. It could also spark an atomic arms race in the Middle East and beyond. A nuclear-armed Iran would therefore be a disaster for Israel and the world. Mr. Trump's desire to stop it is a welcome signal to would-be proliferators across the planet that they should abandon their ambitions. However, Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, faces a grave problem. To remove the threat, he must destroy Iran's wherewithal to make a bomb, or he must eliminate its desire to acquire one. War with Iran is unlikely to achieve either of those things, even if Israel wrecks Iran's infrastructure, thereby postponing the day when it might complete a weapon. It cannot eradicate the know-how accumulated over decades. And far from eliminating the Iran regime's desire to go nuclear, Israeli strikes are likely to redouble it. Mr. Netanyahu's solution is to encourage Iranians to rise up and topple the Islamic Republic. He calculates that a new regime is likely to be less tyrannical, less bellicose, unless wedded to a nuclear program. But Israel can only create conditions that favor a change of regime. It cannot impose a coup from the skies. Besides, nobody knows how willing a new government would actually be to make peace with Israel or to abandon nuclear dreams which, after all, began with the Shah. The conclusion is that the only thing under Israel's direct control is to buy time by setting back Iran's technical capacity to get a bomb. If in a few years Iran renewed its nuclear program, Israel would have to mount another operation all over again. The barriers to success would surely grow. So what is to be done? The G7 meeting in Canada called for de-escalation, and there are reports that Iran wants to negotiate. Diplomacy, if it worked, would indeed be the best way to solve this problem. In contrast to war, it could lead both to the dismantling of the program and also, by building confidence, reduce Iran's incentive to dash for a bomb. That is why Mr. Trump's decision in 2018 to walk out of an imperfect arms agreement with Iran was a terrible blunder. In practice, however, a deal will be very hard to reach. For it to be credible, Iran must agree to give up every ounce of highly enriched uranium, submit to intrusive inspections, and forego all but a token enrichment capacity. Would the regime in Tehran ever accept such humiliating terms as a precondition? Only, if at all, if it fears for its survival. Perhaps sensing that, Mr. Trump has demanded Iran's unconditional surrender, issuing threats that have caused residents to flee Tehran. The best way to apply pressure to Iran, Hawks suggest, would be to leave negotiations for later, and for America instead to shift from merely defending Israel and deterring Iran to joining the attack on Iran's program. This has advantages too. America's bunker-busting bombs are much more likely than Israel's to penetrate key nuclear facilities such as Fordow in central Iran. Iran might talk sooner because it would know that America has the resources to strike it long after Israel's stocks of guided munitions start to run out. Yet for Mr. Trump to enter the fray would be a huge gamble. He was elected to keep America out of wars in the Middle East, even if he intends to hit nuclear targets and nothing else. America could be sucked in. So far, Iran has focused all its strike power on Israel, but it may be saving missiles for a regional assault. It might also have terror cells around the world. Imagine that it now starts to kill American troops and civilians. Or that it sends energy prices soaring by blasting Saudi Arabia's oil industry, or blocking the Strait of Hormuz, a vital waterway for oil and gas tankers. Or perhaps it will hit tower blocks in Dubai or Qatar, beginning a stampede of expatriates who power their economies. Mr. Trump would have to retaliate. Where does that leave America? Fordow is important, but even if it's destroyed, Mr. Trump cannot be sure of eradicating Iran's program once and for all. Secret facilities and stocks of uranium might survive. Know-how definitely would. If Iran is not to go nuclear, America might therefore have to go to war in the Middle East repeatedly, forcing it to choose between non-proliferation and giving full attention to its rivalry with China. Sooner or later, America will come to realize that talks offer the least bad path and that the refusal of Mr. Netanyahu to countenance them is an obstacle. Centrifugal forces. So Mr. Trump faces a trade-off. By doing more damage than Israel could alone, America could set the clock back further. Its participation might also increase the chances that the regime enters talks in earnest or collapses. But those gains are uncertain and must be weighed against the risk of regional conflagration. In a shifting landscape, better for the king of ambiguity to wait to see how far Israel's campaign gets, whether the Iranian regime is willing to talk, and to gauge whether American intervention could tip the balance. And our second leader's article is titled "A New Pug Test, P-U-G. To keep Russia out and America in, NATO must spend more. European members need a hard date to boost their defense budgets." The first head of NATO, Hastings Pug Ismay, I-S-M-A-Y, repeatedly said the alliance's purpose was to, quote, keep the Soviet Union out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. Today, no one wants to keep the Germans down, but as NATO's 32 members gather in The Hague June 24th, most agree that the still essential task of keeping the Russians out requires keeping the Americans in, and that is no longer straightforward. At one point, the summit was in danger of being scrapped. In February, President Donald Trump, along with his Vice President J.D. Vance and his Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, launched a series of verbal attacks on America's European allies, culminating in the humiliation of Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, whom Mr. Trump threw out of the White House. Vladimir Putin was doubtless delighted. NATO suddenly looked more vulnerable than ever before in its 76-year history. Relations have been mended since then. America has quietly continued intelligence sharing and modest arms shipments to Ukraine. The rhetorical attacks on allies have dried up. Mr. Trump, having given up on his campaign promise to end the war in Ukraine in a single day, is no longer pressing Mr. Zelensky to accept terms that would amount to surrender. Mr. Trump is still likely at some point to pull out some of the 80,000 American troops stationed in Europe, yet he has gone quiet about that. The president is right that it makes no sense for 340 million Americans to carry the main burden of defending 600 million Europeans. Europe's economy is about as large as America's. The nation threatening it only has 140 million people and a GDP smaller than Italy's. Russia is Europe's problem, and the surest way to ensure that America continues to help out with the things that only it can provide, such as heavy lift aircraft and intelligence gathering, is for Europe to be seen paying its fair share for its own defense. At the summit, European governments will take a step in this direction. Mark Rutte, that's R-U-T-T-E, who now heads NATO, appears to have secured agreement from its members to raise their target for defense spending from 2% of GDP to an impressive 3.5%, which is even more than America spends. On top of that, there will be an agreement to commit an additional 1.5% of GDP to defense-related categories such as infrastructure, that is, strengthened bridges and roads for carrying heavy equipment and so on, better cybersecurity and support for defense industries. A headline figure of 5% will be something for Mr. Trump to crow about, which matters. Commitments are one thing, fulfilling them's another. The 2% target was agreed to in 2014, but it took pressure from Mr. Trump in his first term and the shock of Mr. Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine for Europeans to take it seriously. Even now, France and Germany barely spend 2%, and Italy and Spain spend far less. Mr. Rutte's task is to secure a hard date for the new spending target of 3.5% of GDP. Early chatter suggests it may be as far off as 2035, since Russia is already gearing up for the next conflict after Ukraine. This is rash. 2030 would be more prudent. Even better would be a series of interim targets, as with curbing carbon emissions. None of this will be easy. Gung-ho countries like France and Britain face huge budgetary constraints. Germany, which can afford to act, has a history of reluctance to rearm. Italy is both reluctant and broke. Raw numbers, anyway, are only part of the puzzle. The money needs to be spent wisely, avoiding duplication and with a good portion allocated to innovative kit and training to give the alliance an edge over Russia's mass armies and extraordinary tolerance for casualties. But you can't do anything without money. If it is to pass an updated version of Pug Ismay's test, NATO needs to up its game, starting next week. And our third leader's article is titled A Fiscal Fable, Japan's Government Bonds. This time it won't end well. Subheading, even as interest costs mount, politicians promise handouts. For years, Japan was a reassuring example for governments, even as its net public debt peaked at 162% of GDP in 2020. It suffered no budget crisis. Instead, it enjoyed rock-bottom interest rates, including borrowing for 30 years at 0.1%. Now, though, Japan is going from comfort to cautionary tale. Government bond yields have risen steadily since 2022 and have surged this year. Interest payments gobble up a tenth of the central government's budget. The central bank is paying out 0.4% of GDP in interest on the mountains of cash it created during years of monetary stimulus, costs that eventually land on taxpayers. Investors are starting to ask if Japan might be vulnerable to a fiscal crisis after all. They're watching especially closely because Japan's bond market has lately acted as a bellwether for sovereign debt across the rich world. The good news is that a crash is not imminent. Japanese bond yields have risen in part because inflation's up, meaning the government can still borrow over most horizons and repay less in real terms than it raises. High inflation has already helped shrink the net debt to around 135% of GDP. Even at Japan's paltry rate of growth, only modest belt tightening is needed to keep the ratio stable. The bad news, though, is that politicians are going in the wrong direction. Ahead of an election to the upper house of parliament, which is due by the end of July, they're locked in a bidding war to shower voters with handouts. Voters are eager to be bribed since inflation has squeezed household incomes. Real wages are down by about 4% since 2019, and the price of rice, the politically sacred Japanese staple, has doubled since the start of 2024, as regulations and tariffs have stopped fresh sources of supply from responding to shortages caused by bad harvests. The main opposition parties want to help stretched households by suspending the 8% consumption tax on food. Others want to halve or abolish the overall 10% rate of tax to help with the cost of living. The government is rightly resisting calls for tax cuts, which, though supposedly temporary, could be hard to reverse. But the Prime Minister, Ishiba Shigeru, has yielded to temptation in other ways. He promises giveaways to households worth 20,000 yen, about $139 per person, and twice that for children and low earners at a cost of about 0.5% of GDP. It is a worrying sign for an indebted country, which, like most of the rich world, faces immense fiscal pressure. On plausible assumptions about future bond yields, the IMF reckons that interest payments could double as a share of GDP by 2030. Moreover, Japan will need to boost its defense spending as America's commitment to its allies frays. In the face of these pressures, politicians could have eased the cost of living with structural reforms, such as deregulating the rice market. Instead, they're reaching for handouts. Fiscal consequences be damned. Although politicians hope to help households, it is households that will suffer if Japan's public finances become riskier. Any dove will tell you that only 12% of the country's debt is held by foreigners, which makes a run on government bonds less likely. But local ownership is a double-edged sword. It means that any fiscal crisis would mostly hurt Japanese people, who would, in all likelihood, have to endure prolonged and destabilizing inflation if public debt became unsustainable. Japanese households are particularly exposed to falls in the purchasing power of the yen. About half of their financial wealth is in bank deposits, compared with about a third in the EU and only 10% in America. Debt, Japanese style. Japan could face more market pressure in the coming months. The central bank is reducing its purchases of government bonds, depriving the market of an important buyer. If inflation proves more persistent than expected, the Bank of Japan might have to raise interest rates faster and higher, worsening the fiscal picture. Donald Trump's protectionism could dent the country's economic growth. If Mr. Ishiba loosens the purse strings, a credit rating downgrade is possible, Japan's was once the ultimate demonstration of bond market placidity. Now it's the first place to look for the start of trouble. And our fourth leader's article is titled Baby Brain, Why MAGA's Pronatalist Plans Are Ill-Conceived. And the subheading, Efforts to Deliver a Baby Boom Either Fail or Cost a Fortune. America's politicians have babies on the brain. In February, President Donald Trump told officials to make IVF cheaper. Even without its procreator-in-chief, Elon Musk, the White House is thought to be working on a bigger package of pronatalist policies. Vice President J.D. Vance is keen. Mr. Trump says he favors a $5,000 handout for new parents. In Britain, meanwhile, Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK, a MAGA-ish opposition party, has proposed tax breaks and benefits to encourage women to have more children. Politicians have long feared the fiscal consequences of an aging population, with too few young workers supporting legions of pensioners. Governments in places with very low birth rates, such as Japan and South Korea, have spent billions trying to reverse the decline with little success. The new pro-natalist policies of the transatlantic right differ from the older ones in that they are more targeted at working-class women whose fertility rate has fallen the most. That might make them a bit more effective, but not at a reasonable cost or without creating perverse incentives. Previous attempts to deliver a baby boom have either failed or been eye-wateringly expensive relative to the number of births they deliver. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban started a big pronatal push in 2011 and has since given parents everything from tax breaks and cash handouts to free childcare. These policies cost a staggering 5.5% of the country's GDP annually, more than almost any government will spend on an aging population in any year between now and 2050. In February, mothers of two were promised a lifelong exemption from income tax. Hungary's fertility rate rose to 1.6 children per woman in 2018 from 1.2 in 2011, making it a poster child for populist pronatalists everywhere. However, it has since dipped, suggesting handouts encourage some mums not to have more babies, but to have the same number sooner. Other countries, including Japan, Norway, and Poland, have tried tax breaks, handouts, maternity leave, subsidized childcare, and even state-sponsored dating, to little effect. Such policies mostly soften the blow to the finances and career prospects of professional women from having children without persuading them to have more. Like Mr. Orban, both Mr. Farage and Mr. Vance see pronatalism as a way to boost the native population over the immigrants they so dislike. However, they would not spend as lavishly as Hungary and would focus the cash more narrowly on poorer parents. Mr. Farage would scrap a cap on benefits, which stops families claiming benefits for more than two children, and boost the threshold below which earnings are exempt from income tax for one half of a married couple. Mr. Trump's handouts would be a bigger relief for poor households than rich ones. Underpinning these policies is an assumption that poorer women are more likely to respond to incentives to have more children. Indeed, their fertility rates do seem more elastic than those of professional women, whereas the fertility rates of older, college-educated women have remained fairly steady over the past six decades. Most of the collapse in fertility in America and Britain since 1980 stems from younger and poorer women having fewer children, particularly from unplanned pregnancies. In 1994, the average age of a first-time American mother without a university degree was 20. Today, about two-thirds of women without degrees in their 20s have never given birth. Mr. Trump's and Mr. Farage's policies might therefore lead to more babies being born than the approaches of places like Norway, which focus on offering child care, a benefit that professional women tend to take up. However, it's implausible that any policies will change a country's demographic trajectory at a less than extortionate price tag. The state should help poor families because they need help, not because it wants them to have more children. There's no evidence that working-class women in America currently have fewer offspring than they actually want, nor is it obvious that encouraging them to procreate would yield a better society. The period of falling fertility rates and fewer teenage pregnancies coincided with more girls staying in school and going to university, which improved their prospects in all kinds of ways. A pronatal policy generous enough to work might encourage them to drop out of education earlier, reversing some of those gains. All in all, best to leave family planning to families. And our fifth and final leaders article today is Computers versus Creatives: What the Cockroaches, that's in quotes, of the ad world teach about dealing with AI. Subheading: A rosé-soaked meeting in Cannes is like a postcard from the future. When advertising executives describe themselves as cockroaches, they're not being self-deprecating. Ad men have shown a remarkable ability to survive what looks like extinction-level events. Copywriters were adapted to radio in the 1920s. Artists embraced TV in the 1950s. Agencies clung on in the early 2000s as ads moved online. This week, in the face of another technological revolution, the ad men steadfastly held their annual jamboree on the French Riviera. The latest upheaval brought by artificial intelligence, or AI, is testing the cockroaches as never before. Advertising is one of the sectors most radically affected by AI so far. As such, Adland offers a postcard from the future for other industries. Three lessons stand out. The first is that the moat between human workers and chatbot rivals is narrower than most people think. Creative work is often seen as immune from automation. Large language models, or LLMs, are designed to predict the most likely answer, which is often the opposite of the most original one. The best ads remain too weird and wonderful for any machine to have dreamt up. Consider the campaign that attached step counters to chickens to advertise free-range eggs. Yet this week in Cannes, TikTok, Meta, Google, and other ad platforms showed off AI-powered features that can create passable video or rewrite ad copy at the click of a button. Their output will not win any awards, but that does not matter. Most of the $1 trillion that is spent on ads each year goes towards workmanlike campaigns rather than con trophy bait. Sam Altman's prediction that AI will one day be able to do 95% of marketing may sound like boosterism for his firm, OpenAI. But the inspired human-made content that people present as a counter-argument is firmly within the remaining 5%. Robots will content themselves with the rest. Another lesson is that the biggest companies have the most to gain. This runs counter to a popular narrative that AI will democratize skills and intelligence. It's true that the new tools from Meta and Company will allow millions of micro businesses to produce the video ads of a quality that was once out of reach and translate text into several languages. Global campaigns can now be launched online for hundreds of dollars. TV-worthy commercials are being put together for a few thousand. But take a step back and it's clear that the serious money is being made by the giants. The selling of ads was already becoming more concentrated. Four tech firms that accounted for a third of the global ad market 5 years ago now account for a half of it. And America's biggest companies are ramping up their AI investment at a faster rate than the rest. No wonder. AI requires computing muscle and large data sets, both of which are expensive. Whereas human intelligence is more or less randomly distributed, the artificial kind can be bought. Rather than democratize access to intelligence, AI may allow the richest to hoard it. The last lesson from Adland is that AI spread will have unpredictable consequences. Some advertisers are shifting their budgets from TV to the humble outdoor billboard. Why? In part because AI has made it possible to infer from vast data sets whether consumers who saw the ad bought the product, allowed marketers to measure the campaign's effectiveness rather than guess at it. And another unexpected winner is old school public relations. As consumers switch from search engines to chatbots, brands need to persuade LLMs to speak highly of them. The most effective way to do that is to influence the sources that the model pays most attention to, such as news articles. In the AI age, high-tech search engine optimization may be less effective than offline schmoozing, or so at least marketers can insist when presenting their post-con expenses claims. Adland is an outlier in important ways. Ad spending is highly cyclical, so the industry has benefited more than most from the AI-fueled boom of recent years. The big tech firms that are active in ads also happen to be leaders in AI and have used ads to test their newest products, and not everyone has the ad man's knack for survival. But the rest of the business world should pay attention to the cockroaches of con. The revolution in Adland is a taste of what is to come. And just past the halfway mark in today's reading, we remind you, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we're reading from the June 21 through 27 edition of The Economist. And turning now to the main section of the magazine, we begin, as usual, with a lead article on the United States. This one's called The Other Half. Democrats could do a lot better with the power they hold. Subheading, more than half of Americans live in states with Democratic governors, and many are poorly run. The video of Brad Lander getting slammed against the wall and arrested by federal immigration agents shocked New Yorkers, who are not easily shocked. On June 17th, the mild-mannered city comptroller had been attempting to escort a migrant through a federal building in Manhattan as agents tried to detain the man. "It's bullshit," said Kathy Hochul, the Democratic governor of New York, of Mr. Lander's arrest. It came a week before a crowded Democratic primary for New York City mayor, in which the city comptroller is a candidate. The arrest may well help his campaign, but it marked yet another skirmish over immigration with Donald Trump's administration. It is just the latest escalation in a confrontation with cities and states that did not vote for the president, on a topic where the publican supports him the most. Mr. Trump's administration has tried to withhold funding from states whose governors, like Janet Mills of Maine, have personally annoyed him. He's now promising to target ICE raids primarily at Democratic cities like New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. Democratic voters clearly want their rudderless party to resist Mr. Trump, but beyond getting arrested, it's not clear how they should proceed. One answer would be to provide a credible alternative of strong government in the places they control. Democrats may now be out of power in Washington, but just over half of Americans live in states with Democratic governors. All but three of the country's 30 largest cities have Democratic mayors. Last year, Mr. Trump's vote share in big cities surged. In Chicago, it nearly doubled from 15% in 2020 to 22%. In New York City, it went from 23% to 30%. That reflects frustration with Democratic governance and with a surge of migrants who arrived during Joe Biden's presidency, putting pressure on cities. The best rebuke to the president would be for Democrats to make the places they govern work. In each of the big cities and states run by Democrats, the problems are similar. The cost of living is enormous, in large part thanks to housing shortages built up over decades. Taxes are high, and yet services are often poor. Infrastructure shoddy. Politics often seems to be more about sharing the loot between special interest groups than about serving the public. Federal stimulus in the form of COVID-19 relief money is running out, and few places have worked out how to replace it. And this is all before the problems that Mr. Trump's vengeance campaign may create. One encouraging change is that the number of mayors realize how serious the problem is and are determined to make changes. Quote, families flee San Francisco for three reasons, end quote. So says Daniel Lurie, San Francisco's reformist mayor. Quote, safety, affordability, and our public schools, end quote. Mr. Lurie, a philanthropist who was elected last year, is one of a clutch of centrist Democrats determined to break with the party's traditional clientelist policies. The list includes Mike Johnson, mayor of Denver, Mike Duggan, mayor of Detroit, and a few others. The biggest problem Democratic cities face is that high taxes and high cost of living have not correlated with excellent services. In San Francisco, the government spends $1.1 billion per year tackling homelessness and yet has a homelessness rate 12 times the national average. In Chicago, total spending on schools passed $34,000 per pupil last year, compared with a national average of $20,000, but scores in reading and mathematics have plunged over the past decade. These costs have been inflated by keeping open near-empty schools that no one wants to close for political reasons. The city's schools have roughly 50% more capacity than needed. In New York, cities and the state collect around $13,000 per person in local taxes, almost twice the average rate. Residents have an easy way to express their dissatisfaction. They can move. Between 2019 and 2024, Americans moved 162 million times, according to postal code data from Melissa, a location data firm. These address changes offer a close, though imperfect, proxy for migration trends. During that period, roughly 750,000 more people moved into Florida than left Florida. Texas follows with 550,000 and South Carolina with 450,000. The loser states were the big three Democratic ones, roughly 1.25 million people more in California left that state than moved into it. New York followed with 1 million and Illinois with 450,000. Life in Phoenix, where temperatures are over 90 degrees Fahrenheit for 190 days a year, is rarely idealized by films or TV shows as New York City's is, but it has several advantages. Housing is cheaper. There's little public transport, but new residents can zip around in their own cars on new wide roads. And Arizona's income tax is just 2.5%. The total burden of taxation is just 9.5% of state net product, compared with 16% in New York. And though the murder rate is a lot higher in Phoenix than it is in New York City, most residents will see less disorder and poverty in their sprawling neighborhoods. For Democrats nationally, there are worrying potential consequences of this migration. The Economist's analysis of zip code level data shows that Americans typically move to districts governed by the same party as the one they left. But when they do cross partisan lines, they're significantly more likely to move from a Democrat-governed area to a Republican one rather than the reverse. Democrats are anxious about what this might mean at the ballot box. After the last census in 2020, Illinois, California, and New York each lost one congressional seat thanks to their relatively anemic population growth. Texas and Florida both gained seats. People still want to live in places like San Francisco, New York, and Chicago. Judged by measures of life expectancy, states that vote for Democrats continue to do better than those that vote for Republicans. High rents are evidence that demand to live in places like New York or San Francisco remains high. One of the best things they could do is build more housing. Analysis by The Economist finds that safely Republican states consistently approve the most housing. Deeply Democratic places approve the least. So why not fix it? In America, power is diffuse. This affects big cities more than it does sparsely populated places. In Los Angeles County, 10 million people live in 88 different cities, with populations ranging from 30,000 to almost 4 million. Power is shared between hundreds of different politicians. Cook County in Illinois, which has 133 individual cities, as well as Chicago, makes even LA's governance look coherent. The whole state of Illinois has 8,500 units of government. Even New York City must fight with Albany to implement policies. That makes getting anything done tricky because there are so many veto points and collective action problems. That's why fixing the housing problem in California is so difficult. While the state recognizes the need for more housing, most local politicians would also prefer it to go somewhere else. LA is just incredibly strange, convoluted, and decentralized, says Chris Elmendorf, a housing law expert at the University of California, Davis. They have a constellation of local interest groups that are super powerful that don't want new housing in their areas. That's the end of a quote from him. In Chicago, work will soon start on an extension of the Red Line, part of the elevated train system some 6 miles into the southern suburbs of the city. It's now expected to cost $1 billion per mile for an above-ground track going mostly through sprawl. Contrast that with the driverless 33.5-mile M4 Metro extension in Copenhagen, which opened last year at a total cost of 10 billion Danish krona, or about 1.5 billion, despite several of its stations being underground. Worse still is California's high-speed rail system, which was meant to connect San Francisco to Los Angeles, but seems unlikely to ever reach either city, despite nearly $14 billion of spending so far. Indeed, the power of public sector and trade unions adds to costs across the board. San Francisco's budget has increased by 46% over the past decade. In 2023, nearly half the budget was devoted to paying its own employees. An analysis from the San Francisco Chronicle found the city had more employees per resident than any other large county in America. In Chicago, Mayor Brandon Johnson negotiated a deal with the city's teachers' union that will increase spending on schools by $1.5 billion. This was less than some feared it might cost, and that's despite that Chicago has a colossal deficit. Even cheap policies get bogged down by resource fights. Congestion pricing in New York's a good example. Last summer, New York's Transit Workers Union, which had initially lobbied for the policy, came out against it, saying they need more upfront investment in transport. The logic for this sort of brinkmanship is simple. If a project is happening, holding out support can let you extract more benefits for yourself. The result is that many projects do not happen at all. Lots of government improvements will cost money or time, and overcoming union power will not be easy. Allowing more housing construction, though, is a free reform. Contrast cities like New York or San Francisco with Republican-run states, and the failure is evident. In Texas, in May, the state passed a law legalizing the construction of apartment buildings with just one staircase, as opposed to the two usually mandated elsewhere in America, but not in other countries. This followed a decision by the city of Austin, run by Democrats, to rezone in 2023. Can Democrats change? Housing gives reason for hope. The state of California has passed dozens of pro-housing laws, imposing strict targets on local governments and chipping away at the many regulations that give leverage to unions and community interest groups to fund, to stop development. This may be at last beginning to bite. In February, Cambridge, Massachusetts, another expensive, NIMBY-ish place, abolished single-family zoning, which banned developers from building apartments. It follows the example of Minneapolis, another city run by a centrist Democratic mayor, Jacob Frey, who started zoning reform in 2020. The city has seen enormous amounts of housing built and falling rents, too. The challenge will be breaking out of the old model of governance. In New York City, neither of the two leading mayoral candidates offers much hope for change. One wants to apply prevailing wage rules to more housing construction, which would make the housing problem worse, and tighten rent control, which would hurt investment. His proposals to make New York more affordable include expensive gimmicks like making buses free and creating city-run supermarkets. The other has a housing plan that seems to have been written by ChatGPT. The most NIMBY, or rather YIMBY, friendly candidate is Mr. Lander, who has an urban planning degree, but polls taken before his arrest gave him little chance. Tight budgets will not make things easy. San Francisco has a deficit of $800 million, and City Hall is bracing for layoffs. We have to tighten our belts, admits Mr. Lurie. The end of COVID-19 relief spending is crunching schools and public transport budgets all over the country. Yet in some ways that makes the case for change stronger. Without it, the risks are high. From the 1950s to the 1990s, an era of lower immigration, America's big cities declined in population. New York City lost almost 2 million residents from 1960 to 1990. Only then did reform begin to materialize. Some Democrats fear that for real change to come to America's biggest cities, it may take a radical shock. With Donald Trump, a shock is what they are getting. And turning now to the section on the Americas, we have an article titled Whacking the Gains, or rather Gangs, from Above. Main heading is Drone Warfare is Hitting Haiti. And the subheading is the gangs have been pushed back in places, but there are concerns that drones are illegal and may ultimately be ineffective. Warfare in the skies has arrived in Haiti. The country's government has been in a vicious and, up until now, losing battle with heavily armed gangs. Over the course of the past year, gangsters have taken control of most of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Now, Haiti's government has started deploying drones, hoping to shift the balance of forces, despite concerns about human rights and the impact on civilians in a densely populated urban battlefield. It was the gangs who began using drones first, mostly to track police movements and to record bird's-eye videos of their attacks to be posted on social media. That changed in March when the government announced it had set up an anti-gang task force equipped with drones, some for mere surveillance and others to carry out kamikaze attacks with explosives on tactical operations. The Haitian police said this soon produced results and showed a grainy video of gang members fleeing one of their strongholds in Port-au-Prince. Once notorious gang leader Andre Johnson, known as Izzo, was reportedly injured by a drone attack in late May. In recent weeks, the police have been carrying out daily drone strikes on gang targets across the capital. They have inflicted heavy casualties, killing 300 gang members and wounding 400, according to a prominent human rights organization, the National Human Rights Defense Network, RNDDH. However, information about civilian casualties is limited because first responders, such as Doctors Without Borders, cannot operate in gang territory. Human rights groups are worried that Haiti's use of explosive drones risks breaking international law because of a lack of clear regulations. Quote, the intentional use of lethal force by law enforcement is legal under international human rights law only when it is strictly unavoidable to protect life when facing an imminent threat and as a last resort when other less lethal alternatives such as capture or non-lethal incapacitation, have been exhausted, says William O'Neill, the UN's designated expert on human rights in Haiti. Despite the risk to civilians, the capital's population has broadly welcomed the drone offensive. Haitians have been terrorized for months on end by armed thugs, many of them young, drug-addled boys forced to commit sadistic acts of violence, including beheadings and rape. There is no alternative, says a former political leader. I don't think we have a choice. There's no way to win with the forces we have. It's death by a thousand cuts. End quote. He describes international concern over supplying such lethal weapons as Haiti's police as just ridiculous. He added, this is pure insurgency. This is Fallujah, referring to a once embattled city in Iraq. Last year, more than 5,600 Haitians died in gang-related violence, and the death toll is rising. In the first 5 months of this year, some 2,680 people were killed, according to UN records. The violence has displaced 1.3 million people, a tenth of the country's entire population. More than 2 million people are seriously short of food. Critics of the drone campaign also question its long-term efficacy. So far, the police have still not permanently dislodged the gangs from the territories under their control, and the government lacks a long-term strategy to retake those neighborhoods. The gangs quickly return, reoccupy the area, and continue committing acts of violence aimed at terrorizing local communities, RNDDH stated in a report on June 12th. Experts say that in the hands of professional soldiers, drones can be remarkably effective, and in urban settings, they can be accurate enough to limit civilian casualties. But drone warfare in Haiti is shrouded in secrecy. Little is publicly known about the rules of engagement or who's entitled to operate the drones. Where are the good guys? Another cause for concern is the persistent allegations that Haiti's politicians have ties to gang leaders and that various members of the Presidential Transition Council are corrupt. Some experts say that the targets of the drone operations are being chosen by the Prime Minister, Alex Phi-Anime, or Aime, and the Transitional Council, without input from the police, opening the door to political vendettas. It's no secret in Haiti that politicians have for years used the gangs to help scrabble for power. As a result, Haiti's gang war is about to get even uglier, says Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a think tank in Washington. In some parts of Port-au-Prince, the police are as big a threat as the gangs, he adds, noting the UN reported an alarming rise in summary execution of unarmed people by the Haitian police. Nor is it clear how the cash-strapped Haitian government is paying for the drones. Some reports suggest rich businessmen are helping the government in return for political favors. In May, gangsters firebombed a car dealership owned by a man they accused of helping supply drones to Haiti's government. Gang leaders are defiant. After a recent drone attack failed to kill Jimmy Cherizier, known as Barbecue, Haiti's most notorious gang leader, he took to social media to ridicule local law enforcement. "I have friends and brothers all over the world," Mr. Cherizier posted. "I have money. Drones are sold everywhere. I can obtain them." He leads a gang coalition that calls itself Vive Ensemble, which means living together. Few doubt the truth of his threat. Three Haitians were arrested in the neighboring Dominican Republic last week and quickly deported back to Haiti after they were caught allegedly trying to buy attack drones for the Haitian gangs. And turning next to the section on Europe, we have the title, Keeping the President Happy. Next week's NATO summit will be all about placating Donald Trump. And the subheading is, the Europeans plan to keep it short and snappy. 4 months ago, Friedrich Merz, freshly triumphant in Germany's election, mused aloud that the largest, longest-lasting, and most successful alliance in modern history might soon evaporate. Quote, "I'm very curious to see how we're heading towards the NATO summit at the end of June," he remarked. "Whether we will still be talking about NATO in its current form, or whether we will have to establish an independent European defense capability much more quickly," end quote. Days away from the summit, NATO's alive, and Mr. Merz has now changed his tune. Again quoting, "I have no doubt whatsoever that the American government is committed to NATO." So he pronounced the day after meeting Donald Trump, America's president, on June 5th at the White House. But the leaders gathering in The Hague on June 24th are taking no chances. The summit will be a short and tightly choreographed affair, minimizing opportunities for Mr. Trump, who walked out of a G7 summit in Canada early June 16th, to cause a ruckus as he did in 2018 when he came close to announcing that America would leave the alliance. The agenda will be dominated by one of Mr. Trump's favorite hobby horses, defense spending. 23 members of NATO now meet the twin targets of spending 2% of GDP on defense and 20% of defense budgets on equipment. In The Hague, the Allies will agree on and announce a new spending target that all Allies should spend 33.5% rather of GDP on what Mark Rutte, NATO's Secretary General, has described as, quote, "core military requirements," end quote, with an additional 1.5% of GDP on defense-related spending, such as infrastructure and industrial capacity. Spain is the only holdout, and it is expected to fold. The real debate now is over the timeline for reaching that target. Central and Eastern European states are pushing for 2032. those with further to go and that are less exercised by the threat, such as Slovakia, want 2035. The former would cause conniptions among many European finance ministries, implying an even more rapid rise in defense spending. The latter would bring to mind the Wales summit of 2014, when allies agreed on a 2% target, but moved towards it with astonishing torpor. Mr. Rutte said that he's also eager to avoid a hockey stick in which allies spend all the money in the last year or two. Quote, "You cannot spend all that money in 1 year. There's an absorption of capacity issue." One senior American official says that concerns that America will pull large numbers of troops out of Europe are likely to be overblown. Most American assets in Europe, including F-35 jets and destroyers, could be moved to the Pacific if needed fairly quickly, he says. It would cost billions of dollars to build the new barracks in America if they'd like to have them there, said Mr. Trump on June 5th to troops in Germany. We do have a lot of them. Nonetheless, European allies increasingly recognize they may not always be able to count on key American capabilities. We need 10 years for this transition, says a European official. 7 years minimum. The direction of travel is clear. Non-American members of NATO, that is Europe plus Canada and Turkey, doubled their spending on equipment between 2018 and 2024, a period in which America's grew by just 5%, according to Jane's, a military data firm. America's share of NATO's total investment spending has fallen from 83% in 2010 to 65% this year. In ordinary times, the Allies would meet and discuss a wide range of other issues. This time around, there's expected to be little or nothing on the challenge posed by China: nuclear weapons and arms control, space security, and NATO's wider neighborhood. The communique traditionally published at the end of the summit is likely to be shorter than usual. If that's the price to pay for placating Mr. Trump, suggest NATO officials, so be it. Quote, "NATO was never established to have a kumbaya," end quote, so reflected Mr. Rutte. Quoting again, "where we would immediately, from minute one, agree on everything," end quote. And with that, we come to the end of this week's reading of The Economist. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader David Leeper, and we've been reading from the June 21 through 27 edition of The Economist. Please join us again next week when we will again read from The Economist.